2,000-year-old reptilian shape-shifting multi-locator's wife goes missing. Another kid disappears while walking to a friend's house. A baby in a bathroom and a missing mother. The lone survivor vanishes. The focus shifts from son to father. Welcome to State of Missing. And welcome back to State of Missing Podcast, episode 33. This is part two. If you haven't listened to part one, I suggest going back and do that. It's some really interesting cases. And I'm here to tell you about five more. I told you about five in part one, and I have, well, I guess it's technically four and a half. I would say it's like four and a half in this part, in part two. Some of them you may have heard about, some of them you may not have heard about, but, you know, I really am excited to tell you about all of them, because they're all interesting cases, and they're all really important, as is every missing persons case. So before we get into the cases real quick, I do want to remind you that this is actually the final episode that we're going to cover in 2021. We're going to come back in January 2022 with a new case. It's going to be one of the big states, either California or Florida. And you'll understand what I mean by big states when I cover it. And it's most likely going to be a multi-parter. But I also have a little surprise that comes with that state. So can't wait to start in 2022. Some big things are going to happen for this podcast in 2022. So without further ado, I guess let's stop with the jabbering and let's get into part two in New Mexico. So we're gonna start this episode off with a bang. This case is probably one of the craziest cases I've ever read about. This one is pretty well known. This is the case of Gurley Chu Hasenkopf. She is case number 2737DFNM in the DOE network. She is also case number MP23129 in NamUs. There is also a Wikipedia page on Gurley. Gurley is an Asian female with black hair and brown eyes. She was born on August 27th of 1963. She was 36 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be 58 now. She is only 5'1" and 95 pounds, so a tiny girl. Her ears are pierced, and in case you were wondering, her maiden name is Chu, and that isn't her middle name. So let's start with a love story. Gurley was born and raised in Malaysia. And in the early 1990s, Gurley traveled to the U.S. for a little vacation. During that vacation, she went to SeaWorld. And while at SeaWorld, she met named Dazian Hasenkopf. Gurley went back home to Malaysia, but she and Dazian kept in touch by writing letters back and forth. And I'm saying Dazian, I think it is. It's D-A-I-Z-I-E-N. But if I mispronounce it at some points, please forgive me. It is going to come up a lot. So, but just know that it is spelled D-A-I-Z-I-E-N. So I think it's Dazian, but I'm not 100% sure. Anyway, so they keep writing letters back and forth. And in 1992, Gurley moved to the U.S. and married Dazian. They moved into a home in the 3900 block of Moon Street in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Let's talk about a man named Armand Chavez. Armand Chavez was born in Houston, Texas on March 5th of 1965. Armand Chavez was a thoracic surgeon with degrees from the University of Tokyo and Cornell Medical College. Wait, no, he wasn't. Armand Chavez is a con artist and fraud who doctored his transcripts and was expelled from medical school. After his expulsion, he changed his name to Diazin Hossenkoft. Then he married Girly Chu. Now, I know you think you know where this is going, and you may be partially right, but there is so much more to this. Diazin had an extensive history as a con artist. He claimed to be a former CIA scientist and also medical doctor. He conned cancer patients out of over hundreds of thousands of dollars by selling them what he claimed was a cancer cure. Turned out he was selling these people looking for a little bit of hope, nothing more but plain old vitamin B6. Among other schemes, Diazin also claimed he was 2,000 years old and had invented a youth serum. Around 1995, the FBI caught wind of Diazin and his schemes. This is because Diazin attempted to purchase a bioreactor from a Philadelphia company under the guise of conducting cell growth experiments. The company, of course, refused to sell the device due to its potential uses, and they contacted the FBI, but Diazin wasn't arrested for any of this. In 1996, a Japanese woman living in Canada gave birth to a son named Dimitri. Shortly after Dimitri's birth, Diazin brought him home to New Mexico and told Girly that Dimitri was a Mexican orphan and they were adopting him. Girly didn't learn that Dimitri was actually Diazin's biological son that she was raising until 1998 or 1999. So now we know that not only is Diazin a con artist, he's a cheater. So let's add something else. Now, Girly knew that Diazin was unfaithful during their marriage. In late 1998, Diazin was cited for domestic violence incident after choking Girly and threatening to kill her. Girly told police that Diazin became enraged when she confronted one of his girlfriends and the woman decided to end her relationship with Diazin. So now we know that Diazin is also an abuser. Girly had enough, so she moved out of their shared residence in January of 1999. She moved into an apartment in the 8400 block of Spain Road, and she got a job at a bank. Shortly after that, she hired an attorney, and she initiated divorce proceedings for good. So, good for Girly, right? This seems like everything is going in the right direction, right? Now, Girly had told a coworker and an FBI agent that was investigating Diazin that Diazin had repeatedly threatened to kill her. She was so concerned about these threats that she told her coworker to contact police and ask them to investigate Diazin if anything ever happened to her. Girly had already suspected him of smashing her car's windshield on two separate occasions after she had moved out. Girly had also started taking karate lessons for self-defense. Now, in the meantime, in the summer of 1999, Diazin had begun an affair with a woman named Linda Henning from Albuquerque. Girly also learned that Diazin was trying to place their son for adoption with another couple around this time. Investigators think that he wanted Girly to drop any custodial or property rights and thus began plotting her murder. On September 9th of 1999, Girly finished her work shift and heads home as usual. We learn that several hours later, Diazin sped into the driveway on Moon Street. His neighbors take note and reported that they observed Diazin's face and neck were covered in black grease paint. He also appeared to be wearing a forest green or camouflage shirt. The next day, September 10th, Girly was scheduled to be at work for 8 a.m. Girly wasn't at work before 8. Her co-workers contacted police to report Girlie's possible disappearance by 8:10. So her coworkers knew what was going on. They were on the ball. When she wasn't early or right on time, they contacted police. I mean, I guess in most other situations, if you were a little bit late to work, maybe you overslept or you slept through your alarm or, you know, something like that, you got caught in traffic. But I think that her coworkers were pretty well aware of the situation that was going on, so they acted quickly, and I think in this case, it helped a lot, as we'll see. So police and investigators head on over to Girlie's apartment. In her apartment, they discover evidence of a struggle, including pools of blood that appeared to be wiped with bleach. The testing of that blood later did provide some interesting results. There were three contributors to that blood. One was obviously Girlie, one was an unknown contributor, and the third we'll get to. Girlie's blood splattered pink and orange shorts, green and white blouse, and green panties were discovered later that day on the side of Highway 60, southeast of Belen, New Mexico. The clothes had been wrapped in a blood-stained gray tarp along with some duct tape with a strand of hair attached. We also know who that hair belonged to, and it wasn't Girlie's. Girlie's purse had also been discarded on a nearby street. So I'm sure you're wondering where Deazen is during all of this. Well, prior to Girlie's disappearance, Deazen told his neighbors that he was dying of leukemia and had 5 months left to live. He told several people that he planned to visit Toronto, Ontario, Canada, or El Paso, Texas for medical treatment. Deazen left Albuquerque on September 10th and traveled to South Carolina, where he was eventually arrested several weeks later. The arrest was for placing threatening phone calls to three people in New Mexico. So nothing to do with Girlie, initially at least. In October of 1999, Linda Henning, Deazen's girlfriend, was charged with making false statements to a grand jury about Girlie's disappearance. Authorities learned that she believed Deazen's false claims and attempted to convince her friends that he was an established scientist. Now, Linda Henning's loved ones insisted that she had been drugged and or brainwashed by Deazen because her behavior changed when they began dating. Before meeting Deazen, Linda had never been in trouble with the law, yet here we are. In November of 1999, both Linda Henning and Deazen Hossenkopf were indicted for the murder of Girlie Chu Hossenkopf. Remember that blood? Well, that third contributor was Linda Henning. Remember that hair attached to the tape? Well, that was Linda's too. Deazen pleaded guilty in January of 2002 to his role in Girlie's murder. He did so to avoid the death penalty. Instead of death, he was sentenced to life plus 61 years in prison. Now Linda, she pled not guilty to charges of first-degree murder and went to trial during the summer of 2002. At Linda's trial, Deazen testified that he was a reptilian shapeshifter and capable of being in several places at once. He also implied that Girlie's body had been cannibalized. Deazen said that he allowed militia member William Bill Miller to murder Girlie for practice before the climax with the Alien New World Order. So we're really getting into some stuff here. Deazen claimed that he stopped at his estranged wife's apartment at a prearranged time on September 9th and attempted to clean the blood and additional evidence left at the scene. Deazen said he returned to his house and located a refrigerated vial of an unidentified woman's blood. He would collect these blood samples from people under the guise of scientific research, and I guess he stored them in his refrigerator. He claimed that the vial broke before he could pour it in inside Gurley's apartment to confuse investigators. He said he did use a sample of Linda's blood in its place and diluted it with bleach in an effort to impede the DNA testing. Dyson claimed that Linda was not involved in Gurley's murder, and in fact, he claimed that Miller was the only perpetrator. Linda was found guilty anyways, and she was found guilty of murder, kidnapping, conspiracy, perjury, and evidence tampering, but she was acquitted of 10 other charges. Her sentence was 73 years in prison, but she was spared the death penalty. Investigators did not believe Miller was responsible for Gurley's murder, but he was charged with evidence tampering. He pled guilty on that charge and was sentenced to only 10 months of probation. Now, I'm not sure exactly how this William Miller gets involved in all of this, but obviously he becomes part of it and gets sentenced for tampering with some evidence. That part of this case wasn't extremely clear. So now, to this day, Gurley's body has still not been found. Dyson never revealed the location of Gurley's body, but of course, according to him, she was eaten. Authorities believe that Gurley's body is probably within Saguaro County, possibly somewhere along US 60 near the Till. I'm not sure where that is, but I guess anywhere along US 60, because obviously that's where they found her clothing and her purse. So I think they theorize that because that's where her property was, she's likely to be close. So I'm not sure, but that is a super crazy case, right? This was just a pretty brief coverage of the case, but you can definitely find more extensive coverage of this case other places. In fact, Crime Junkie, which is one of my favorite podcasts, covered this case really well in a December 7th, 2020 episode entitled Murdered, Gurley Chu Hasenkopf. I enjoyed it, and they definitely covered it more extensively than I did, so I suggest going over there and give it a listen. If you do know anything about the whereabouts of Gurley Chu Hasenkopf, please contact the Albuquerque Police Department. Okay, so here we go with a juvenile case. This is one of two juvenile cases I'm going to cover in part two. And this one's kind of sad. This is another interesting case, although there is not a ton of information online about this case. There is some pretty interesting details about it. So let's get into the disappearance of Robert Marcos Romero. He is case number 4478DMNM in the Doe Network, case number MP6599 in Namus, and his NCMEC number is 887928. Robert is a Hispanic male with brown hair and brown eyes. He was born on April 10th of 1993 and was 7 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 28 now. He stood between 3'9" and 4'5" and between 50 and 80 pounds at 7 years old. He was last seen wearing a white t-shirt, jeans, and black and white sneakers. Robert goes by Robbie and has freckles on his face, and about a week before his disappearance, he had gotten a buzz cut. We're just going to get straight to the disappearance. Robbie was last seen at about 7 p.m. on June 7th of 2000. Robbie lived in Santa Fe and was last seen as he was walking 3 blocks away from his friend's home in the 2900 block of Bellema Drive. He never arrived at the friend's house, and he was never seen again. So Robbie's family looked for him for several hours after he was last seen. After about 8 hours, they finally contacted law enforcement. Now, I don't know if this is because law enforcement told them they had to wait 8 hours, or that's just how long they decided to wait. So law enforcement gets involved, and they searched Robbie's house, Robbie's family's vehicles, and their yard, and they even tested the family's couch in an attempt to uncover evidence relating to his disappearance. They didn't find anything. Law enforcement quickly draws this theory that Robert knew his possible abductor or abductors, or that the person or persons involved may have known him. Do you see where this may be going? It gets a little complicated. Police do have a person in mind that they want to talk to. Apparently, there was a man in the neighborhood the week of Robbie's disappearance. This man was riding a bicycle and had long hair with a tinge of gray. Police think that this man may have seen what happened to Robbie. Unfortunately, this mystery man has never been identified and has yet to be located. So here's something. Robbie has an older brother. At the time when Robbie was 7, his older brother was 22. Robbie's brother, Ronnie, failed 3 polygraphs about his brother's disappearance. So why are they even looking at Ronnie? Well, apparently investigators thought that his behavior was a little odd following Robbie's disappearance. He apparently stayed in his room alone and slept late while the rest of the family searched for Robbie. Ronnie told police that he had taken Robbie to a park to play football on the morning of June 7th, the day he disappeared. The thing was that investigators were able to determine that Ronnie was at a party the night before and he had slept all the next morning. 10 days after Robbie's disappearance, a female acquaintance of Ronnie contacted investigators, and she had something interesting to tell them. She said that Ronnie had confessed to her that he had caused Robbie's death and hid his brother's body. Ronnie allegedly said that he had hid the body very well and no one would ever find it. This woman's story has not been verified, of course. On top of this, about a month after Robbie's disappearance, Ronnie was interviewed by police. During that interview, Ronnie allegedly asked about the penalties for manslaughter. He further asked how much time the perpetrator would get if Robbie had been killed accidentally. And as if this couldn't get even more incriminating, 5 weeks after Robbie's disappearance, Ronnie accused his girlfriend of killing Robbie. He called 911 and said his girlfriend had confessed to running Robbie over with her car and putting his body in a dumpster. He demanded that the police go arrest his girlfriend. When police do show up at the house, Ronnie's girlfriend was dead asleep. So police wake her up and they asked her about this alleged confession. She said she absolutely did not make that confession and, in fact, had no idea what they were even talking about. So investigators talked to Ronnie at the police station later that day. At that point, he related the alleged confession in detail. He identified the exact place where he said Robbie had been hit and even described the injuries to Robbie's body. Both Ronnie and his girlfriend agreed to take polygraphs. Ronnie took his, but the girlfriend ended up backing out. Ronnie failed his polygraph. Investigators say they do not believe that Ronnie's girlfriend killed Robbie, although they do think that she knows more than she let on. This woman was never publicly identified, and now she lives outside of New Mexico and actually works in law enforcement. Robbie's loved ones have said that they felt harassed by law enforcement officials, especially after Robbie's disappearance. Some members of Robbie's family filed a lawsuit against the city of Santa Fe and its police department. They alleged that the initial mishandling of Robbie's case may have led to his death. For the lawsuit, the family requested access to the police department's files on the case, but the judge denied the request because it is still an ongoing investigation. In late 2005, Robbie's mother, Evelyn, told reporters that police were seeking an indictment against Ronnie in Robbie's case. She said that she had been subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury regarding Robbie's case. She also said that her two minor children were taken from her custody temporarily. They have, of course, since been returned. Authorities could not confirm Evelyn's statement, saying that they couldn't comment on grand jury investigations. Ronnie was arrested in January of 2006 on unrelated charges, though. There have been no arrests in Robbie's disappearance to date. It should be noted that all of Robbie's family members took polygraph exams, but Ronnie is the only person that failed his. All of Robbie's loved ones maintain that they are not involved in Robbie's disappearance. Robbie's father died in October of 2002, which is why he was not mentioned much in this case. Now, Ronnie died in 2008 while in a Santa Fe jail at the age of 30. Cause of death was determined to be a drug overdose. So, what do y'all think? Was it Ronnie? Was it Ronnie's girlfriend? Maybe the man on the bicycle? Maybe a random abduction? I think most people who read about this case have the same opinion. I found a well-detailed timeline of this case by the Santa Fe New Mexico.com, and I'll post it in the show notes, but it has definitely more information there than I provided here. I think this is a pretty sad case all the way around. I really do feel bad for Robbie's family. Not that I don't feel bad for all the families of the missing, of course. In this case, though, there just seems to be much inner family dynamics, and I don't know if a strong or 100% well-adjusted, functional, together family could outstand the weight of everything that was going on in this case. But if you do have any information about the disappearance or possible whereabouts of Robert Marcos Romero, please contact the Santa Fe police or local law enforcement. So I have a lot about this next case. This disappearance occurred in 2012, but there are some updates in this case as recent as July of this year, 2021. Let's get into the disappearance of Cindy L. Rivera. She is case number 3927DFNM in the Doe Network and case number MP18889 in Namus. Cindy is a Hispanic female born on February 14th, Valentine's Day of 1993. She was 19 at the time of her disappearance and would be 28 now. She was 5'1" and 134 pounds at 19. She has brown hair and brown eyes. She was last seen wearing a white spaghetti strap top, pink silk pajama pants with heart designs, and slippers. Now, Cindy has several tattoos that include the name Rhonda, R-H-O-N-D-A, on the right side of her neck, the phrase "trust no bitch" across the front of her collarbone, faces, and the phrase "smile now, cry later" on her right arm, the word Tyga, T-Y-G-A, with stars on her right hand, and the word Bites, B-I-T-E-S, with hearts on her left hand. Cindy's ears are pierced, and her lower lip is pierced on both sides, so she has snake bites. Cindy's nickname is Tig, and she may use the last name Trujillo. In June of 2012, Cindy was living with her father, but on the evening of June 29th, Cindy and her one-year-old son were spending the night at her mother's house on Peggy Lane in Las Vegas, New Mexico. The owner of that house on Peggy Lane was an elderly, bedridden man. Cindy's mother was the man's caretaker. On the evening of June 29th, Cindy's mother was not at the house. She was staying at a friend's house. Some places say it was her boyfriend. I don't think it really matters. And Cindy was kind of taking her mother's place at the house and was supposed to be taking care of the man while her mother was away. At about 2 a.m. on the 30th, Cindy called her mother and told her that Cindy's ex-husband, Christopher Trujillo, had showed up to the house drunk. Christopher is also the father of the one-year-old son. Cindy, of course, did not sound scared or concerned, so her mother just told her to get rid of him and go inside. Around daybreak later that morning, Cindy's relatives show up to the house. Oddly, the garage door was open and Cindy's lighter and her cigarettes were on the ground. They go into the house, and what they discover is that Cindy is not inside. Even worse, her son was locked in the bathroom, and the bedridden man had heard him crying all night and was unable to do anything about it. Cindy was nowhere to be found, and Cindy's mother contacted police and reported her missing. Police arrive at the residence on Peggy Lane and search the property. Besides the cigarette and lighter, police also find Cindy's slippers in two different parts of the yard and signs of a struggle. Here's what we learn later. Later that same day that Cindy had disappeared, Chris Trujillo's family saw him and his friend Anselmo Richard Archimo Ortiz. And they say that Chris and Chimo were shirtless and had scratches and bite marks on their chests. Chimo's ex-wife and her mother also saw them and noted that Chimo's neck and Chris's face were bloody. Chimo's ex-wife also said that Chimo had a Walmart bag full of clothes that appeared to be bloody, and he burned them in a fireplace. Chimo's ex-wife also said that on the evening of June 29th, he called her and said he was done and that he was going back to prison for the rest of his life. He later said to her, if anything happened to Cindy, Chris did it. She said he also told her that he didn't kill Cindy, but admitted he'd helped bury her body. That all, of course, came out later, though. Now, cell tower data indicated that on July 1st, Chris and Chimo had left New Mexico and traveled to Victorville, California. Cell data showed the two men were in Las Vegas, New Mexico, between 12:30 and 4 a.m. on June 30th. After Cindy's disappearance, Chimo is arrested and imprisoned on drug trafficking charges. He was imprisoned from 2013 to 2019. Now, what is Chris doing during this period? Well, I'm not too sure, but we do know that at some point he opens a business called All American Towing in Las Vegas, New Mexico. We know this because when Chimo is released in 2019, Chris gives him a job at his company. What's happening in Cindy's disappearance during this time period? Honestly, I don't know. Maybe investigators were putting the pieces together. Maybe they were looking for Cindy's body. maybe they thought she was alive and just ran away. I'm not sure. I do know that Cindy's family wasn't giving up. They had an idea about what happened to Cindy from day one, and they had an idea of who hurt her. They even offered a $50,000 reward for the person with information that would bring justice for Cindy. Now, apparently, after Chimo began working for Chris, their relationship began to deteriorate. I don't know about the timeline of this, but apparently Chimo was being accused of using the company credit card on personal items. And then later, Chris accused Chimo of ratting him out to his wife about an affair, and this results in Chris threatening to harm Chimo's son. Now, things really began to heat up in Cindy's case at the beginning of this year, 2021. In January, Chimo was arrested for a DUI. In April, he went to investigators wanting to talk about Cindy's case, but he didn't want to tell them anything unless they were willing to offer immunity from all charges. Not only that, he wanted the $50,000 reward. Police were not willing to give him immunity or the money, and he didn't stop trying, though. He reached out to Cindy's family on Facebook on April 30th. One of those messages said, "I can honestly say I didn't have anything to do with it, but there's a chance I could be wrong about the locations or he has done something else." As this is going on, Chris is unraveling, apparently. I don't know if he was aware that Chimo was reaching out to Cindy's family, but apparently Chris and his wife were arguing about Chimo. Chris was accusing his wife of having an affair with Chimo now. On May 2nd, Chris's wife makes contact with state police and expresses concerns that Chris wanted to kill himself and Chimo. On May 4th, Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office responded to a call in La Cienega in reference to a death by suicide. Upon arriving, they locate one Christopher Trujillo, deceased. After Chris's death, investigators go through his cell phone. In the phone, they found several recorded conversations. One conversation was particularly interesting. In this recording, Chris says, "I killed my ex-wife, Cindy Rivera, and buried her in the National Forest. I'm going to tell them Chimo killed her and buried her." In July, New Mexico State Police obtained an arrest warrant for one Anselmo Richard Ortiz. In this case, the arrest warrant was for kidnapping and conspiracy to commit kidnapping. He also had some other active warrants for other incidents, though, apparently. One was for driving with a revoked license and another for car theft. The vehicle theft charges were for allegedly stealing a car on April 9th of 2021 from Chris's towing company. It's not long before Chimo is arrested on all of these warrants and booked into San Miguel County Jail. So that's all I have at this point. So I think the case seems pretty clear for investigators. They think Cindy was kidnapped and killed on the morning she disappeared, and they believe Chimo helped Chris or was involved. As far as Cindy's body, I haven't seen anything about any searches, but hopefully something comes soon. Of course, it's too early to know anything about any pleas or sentencing in Chimo's arrest, so this is still an ongoing case and one that I believe could be fully closed soon, especially if Chimo cooperates for a lesser sentence. If you do have any information in this case, the New Mexico State Police is the investigating agency. This next case is oddly interesting, so we're just going to jump into the disappearance of Eduardo Ramirez Lamas. He is case number MP30968 on NamUs. He is not on the Doe Network, and that's probably because this case is more recent. Eduardo is a Hispanic male who stands at 6'5" and between 230 and 250 pounds. I don't have his date of birth, but he was 22 at the time of his disappearance and would be about 28 now. He has brown hair and brown eyes, and at the time of his disappearance, he had a goatee and a beard, but he would change his facial hair quite often. He has a long surgical scar on the back of his right hand. He also has a tattoo of a Latin phrase on his upper chest, although they don't specifically say what that Latin phrase is. So, on September 21st of 2015, Eduardo was at home in Albuquerque with his girlfriend and their baby. At about 10 a.m., Eduardo decides he's going to head to the gym. He walked out the door and was never seen again. In the parking lot of the apartment building next to his car, police found Eduardo's gym membership card, his cell phone, and a broken bottle. So there it is. You can contact Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department with any information. No, you know it's not that open and shut. What's the backstory, right? Well, it's really not much of a backstory, but there is something you may want to know. On September 7th of 2015, 2 weeks before Eduardo's disappearance, he was involved in a little incident. Eduardo and three friends, Christopher Gonzalez, Joshua Volker, and Nicholas Leckie, headed over to an address on Washington near Gibson Southeast. The house they were going to was owned by a man named Justin Mack. Eduardo and his friends arrived at the residence wearing masks and armed with guns. They forced their way into the home, and let's just say things didn't go as planned. The homeowner, Mack, grabs a gun and shoots and ultimately kills two of them, Christopher Gonzalez, who was 18, and Joshua Volker, who was 25. Eduardo ran back to the car that they had all arrived in, but apparently he didn't leave right away or quickly enough. The fourth robber was found a few blocks away from the house. Nicholas Leckie was deceased by a gunshot wound to the head. It was determined that he committed suicide. Now, Eduardo not leaving quickly obviously was not smart, but what was kind of smart was when police arrived, he was obviously still there, and he claimed to be a witness to the whole incident. Apparently, it didn't take long before police saw right through this, and he was arrested, and once he's arrested, they bring him in, and he spills it. He says Mac, the homeowner, is a drug dealer, and they were going to rob him. Now, police do end up finding heroin and meth in a safe in Mac's house. He was charged with trafficking once the drugs were found, but those charges were eventually dropped. Mac was never charged for the two murders because those were deemed self-defense. Eduardo was booked into jail and charged with armed robbery, but he didn't stay long because he was bailed out on September 9th. After being bailed out, Eduardo attended all of his court dates right up to his disappearance. Investigators can't say that they're sure of what happened. They seem torn between the possibility of foul play and the idea that Eduardo staged his own disappearance to avoid the charges he was facing. Eduardo's sister has an opinion, though. She says she had heard that someone wanted to kill Eduardo, and she thinks that something bad did happen to him. So as I mentioned earlier, Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department is handling Eduardo's disappearance, so if you know what happened or where he is, you can contact them. So, we've arrived at the last case I'm covering out of New Mexico for this round. In part one, I told you about a case that I kind of decided not to cover, and thus covered the case of Skyla Marburger instead. Now, I picked this case initially because of the details, and it's a juvenile. But this case no longer is considered a missing persons case, which is why I wasn't going to cover it. This is a seen again case, or I guess now it would be a state of found case. Let's talk about Ociel Ernesto Rico. I found this case on the Charlie Project because I guess they hadn't updated it, and it's not anywhere else as far as the databases are concerned. I won't go through all of the descriptive details because he's not being looked for anymore, and he is still a juvenile, so I'm going to protect him from all that for a little while. But I will tell you, you know, just some basic pivot points here. Ociel is a Hispanic male who was 3 at the time of his disappearance in 2020, and he is 5 now. So Ociel disappeared from Roswell, New Mexico on January 5th of 2020. This is our first disappearance from Roswell. Is this an alien abduction case? Well, let's just see. On January 5th, family members found the body of his mother, Isela Mauricio Sanchez, in her house in the 600 block of East 4th Street. Although his mother was found deceased, Ociel was nowhere to be found. It was presumed that Ociel was abducted by his non-custodial father, Jorge Ernesto Rico Rivera. Jorge was Isela's boyfriend and the prime suspect in her murder. This conclusion is drawn from a number of things, including, but not limited to, a history of domestic violence in the relationship. Jorge had been charged with aggravated battery against a household member in October of 2019 after it was alleged that he had choked Isela. And I'm saying Isela, it's I-S-E-L-A. Apparently, in the house, there were signs of a struggle. The closets were cleaned out, and Isela's maroon 2003 GMC Yukon was missing. I also read something that suggested that Jorge locked Isela's daughter in the same house that Isela lay dead in. I'm not sure how true that is, but there is a charge of child abuse in this case. I also don't know how old that child was, or if Jorge was the father of that child or not. Presumably not. Isela was 27 at the time of her death. Jorge was 32. He is a Hispanic male born on November 17th of 1987. He is 5'8", 150 pounds, with black hair and brown eyes. I tell you that because there is still an active warrant for Jorge for charges of first-degree murder, second-degree retaliation against a witness, third-degree abandonment or abuse of a child, and aggravated battery, and those charges are out of New Mexico. But a federal warrant was also issued for unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. They believe Ociel and Jorge may be in Mexico because Jorge was born there and has family members in the states of Zacatecas and Jalisco. But 3 days before Isela's murder, Jorge had told his neighbors that ICE had ordered him to go back to Mexico, and this was ultimately determined to be untrue, as ICE did not even have him in their database to begin with. It was also believed that they could still be traveling in that maroon GMC. On October 12th of 2021, authorities say Ociel had been found safe. The only thing is that the FBI will not say when, where, or how Ociel had been located. One conclusion that I will go around and draw is that Ociel was not recovered in the presence of Jorge because Jorge was not reported to have been arrested. The warrants for Jorge are still active also. So while I am glad that OCL is safe, I would still like Jorge to be in custody. So I guess this turned from the disappearance of OCL to the disappearance of Jorge. I imagine Jorge is not in the US because it would be really stupid if he was, and highly unlikely. He's probably in Mexico, but if you do know where Jorge is, you can contact local law enforcement or any law enforcement so that they can be arrested and face the, or he can be arrested and face the charges against him. So that's it. We are all done. That wrapped up part two of New Mexico, and I have nothing more to give you out of New Mexico for now, at least. I want to thank everybody for listening to part one as well as part two. Thank you for your continued support. And if you haven't done so already, please go like, favorite, rate, and/or review on whatever platform you listen on if any of those are an option. Those go a long way to helping me climb the rank boards and thus getting this podcast noticed. I do work really, really hard on putting these podcasts together. It takes a lot of time out of my week sometimes, and I've been working really hard to get these out on a scheduled basis. You can go ahead and follow the social medias. On Facebook, the page is still under the old name, which is Never to Be Seen Again. So you can search that up, Never to Be Seen Again podcast on Facebook, and the page should come right up. And go ahead and follow it because I post when new episodes are up, and I also post the pictures of the missing that I talk about in each episode. I also have an in, or we also have an Instagram. If you haven't done so already, go and follow that. I think it's State of Missing Pod on Instagram. So go check that out. I do the same thing there that I do on Facebook. I post when new episodes are up. I post the new pictures, or I post the pictures from each case so that way you can check out who I'm talking about while I'm talking about them or after I talk about them or, even before if you're going to be too busy to catch the case when it first or catch the episode when it first comes out. Also, if you have any case suggestions, when we come back in 2022, we're going to be working huge states. So if you have any suggestions out of California or Florida, shoot me a message on any of the social medias. You can shoot me an email at either of the two email accounts. That's stateofmissingpod@gmail.com or nevertobeseenagainpodcast@gmail.com. Either of those, they're both still up and running. If you listen to this on Anchor, I think Anchor also has the option to send a message, which I think ends up at the email address regardless. So please, I'm really looking for help in California and Florida. We're looking at thousands of cases in those two states, and I'm really trying to figure out what the best course of action is to get or to select cases from those two states or how I'm going to do it because I can't go through thousands of cases to handpick the ones that I want. I just don't have that kind of time, and honestly, they're just going to start blurring into each other after a certain point. So if you have any suggestions, if you could help me out in that aspect, I would absolutely love it. If you know of any case, if you've seen about a case out of Florida or California, just shoot me a name. I'm not asking you to do any research. I'll do the research. I just need suggestions so I don't have to go through, thousands of cases. So I hope everyone has a good holiday, and that you come back in 2022. 2022 is gonna be an amazing year for this podcast. I'm going to put it out into the universe right now. 2022 State of Missing Podcast is going to blow up, and everybody's going to know this podcast in the year 2022. I'm going to have some pretty good things going on in 2022, as well. We're going to talk about some interesting things on the podcast that might have a surprise here and there. So please continue to listen. And 2022 is the year that you grace your friends. You give the presents, or you give the present of this podcast to your friends. If you ran out of time, you forgot about a Christmas present, you know, if you forgot, you know, that you needed to gift them this podcast, be like, here is your gift. I'm telling you about this podcast. So I do appreciate everybody who listens every week. Thank you for your continued support. I really couldn't ask for better listeners in the United States, in England, everywhere that you listen, because I know Australia, England, I have a lot of listeners throughout the world. Thank you. I can't say that enough. Thank you. And I know that I wasn't producing episodes for a large portion of the year, but I'm so happy and so grateful that when I came back with this podcast, that there were so many people here to support me in this podcast. I really am touched and so grateful to everybody who has been on this journey, who has started listening, who just started this journey with me, with us. Thank you. I'm forever grateful. And please continue to listen. So I'm going to wrap it up for 2021. Please come back for 2022. We're going to do big things. Okay, bye, y'all.